The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm excited to be here to introduce tonight's author, Andrea Elliott. An investigative reporter at the New York Times, Andrea Elliott won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing for a series of articles on Sheikh Reda Shatta, an Egyptian-born imam living in Brooklyn. She formerly worked as a staff writer at the Miami Herald, where she covered immigration and Latin American politics. The winner of Columbia University's Medal for Excellence, the George K. Polk Award, the Scripps Howard Award, and prizes from the American Society of Newspaper Editors and the Overseas Press Club, Elliott was a visiting journalist at the Russell Sage Foundation, an Emerson Fellow at New America, and received a Whiting Foundation grant. She joins us tonight with Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. Based on her 2013 five-part series for the New York Times on the plight of children experiencing homelessness in New York City, this debut book, according to a recent New York Times review, goes well beyond her original reporting in both journalistic excellence and depth of insight, end quote, to document eight harrowing years in the life of a girl named Dasani, who's helping her family navigate the disastrous effects of widening income equality and a disappearing social safety net. That review continues, quote, "The reporting has an intimate, almost limitless feel to it," end quote, and that the result is a rare and powerful work whose stories will live inside you long after you've read them. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Reginald Dwayne Betts. Mr. Betts is a Yale Law School graduate and is the author of a memoir and three poetry collections, including the award-winning Felon. He is also a very recent MacArthur Foundation Fellowship recipient. So huge shout out on that. Congratulations. Andrea, Dwayne, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is all yours.
This is kind of cool. I got to say that, one, I'm honored to be here with you. And I feel like I would be remiss not to start it this way. You know, we write and we work, and I think the reason why we do it, like, sort of stretch and extend. And so I just wanted to publicly thank you for doing this and just acknowledge that it's a lot, you know, and family is really important. And I don't want to be like whatever I might be, but, you know, it's a eulogy about your dad in the Washington Post. And I just feel like I want to acknowledge it partly because,
yep. Thank you.
You know, that's the way we think about the lives that we've lived, you know? So I want to say condolences as we start.
Thank you so much, Dwayne. I really appreciate that. Dwayne knew that two weeks ago, my father, who is very, very dear to me, died unexpectedly. And he was very important to my work. So I feel him in the room right now, and I really appreciate you saying that. And I'm just so delighted to be here with you, especially after you just won this much deserved and extraordinary honor. And I think this is going to be a very enriching conversation.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I don't know how we characterize whether or not people deserve anything they get, particularly in the context of your book. You know, I think what your book reveals is that a lot of people don't deserve what they get. And to open this up, because I know a lot of people who'll be in this talk who may have read the Congratulations on the Cover story that was in the New York Times Magazine, which is a great introduction to the book. Some people may have read that. Some people may have read the earlier piece, but they might not have. So just, can you just give us a brief take on like who Dasani is first, you know?
Sure, yes. So Invisible Child follows 8 years in the life of Dasani Coates, who was 11 years old and homeless when I met her in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. She was growing up in a neighborhood that was very much a new version of Brooklyn, the gentrified Brooklyn that has become a kind of famous symbol of that whole phenomenon. And it's a neighborhood, much like many other parts of urban America that are, is increasingly divided between rich and poor. She was one of more than 22,000 homeless kids when I met her. And I wanted to find a way into this story because I found it stunning that, and I kind of stumbled upon this statistic, Duane. I had been rereading Alex Kotlowitz's There Are No Children Here, which is a book from the 80s. And I kept thinking, how much has changed? Because this book was from about Chicago and these two brothers in Henry Horner houses in 1986. 20 years later, what's really changed? And actually it turned out that we had the exact same child poverty rate as that period in 2012, the same, which was around 1 in 5 kids, which is the highest child poverty rate of almost any wealthy nation in the world. And so, and the costs are great to society when you have roughly a fifth of the future workforce growing up in adversity. And so that's what got me started. But right in New York, we had this homeless crisis and 22,000 kids, if you think about it, that is a crowd that would fill Madison Square Garden. And there would be overflow. So I just wanted one. And I was standing outside her shelter talking to families. She walked out with her mother. And I was basically hooked on that family because they captivated me just from the very moment I met them. They were and continue to be just full of surprises and electricity and all kinds of wisdom. And look, whether they were a poor family or I was writing about them in a religious context or I was writing about them as people in Fort Greene, it didn't really matter the way in, the entree. The thing I arrived at was just pure fascination. Chanel, Dasani's mother, who's named after the perfume, she's kind of a walking poet.
She was cool. She has a lot of character.
She lights up the page. That's what I feel. But every time I started to write about her, I would feel it like, just excited. Dasani is another firecracker in her own way. She just had, I'm a mother. I have two children. I know how hard it is to draw them out. And my kids like to talk, but a lot of kids don't. And I had interviewed a lot of children at that point. I'd gone around. I had crossed state lines. I'd looked in different places for the right story. And almost no kid did what Dasani did, which was she wanted to narrate her story. She wanted to tell me her story. She was so full of words. And I remember one of the first quotes she gave me about the room they were living in. This is a family of 10 crammed into a room in a decrepit city-run shelter in one of the richest cities in the world, where nearly half of New Yorkers were living near or below poverty. There were mice running around the room and roaches, and the family had to hang their food from the ceiling in plastic bags. And, she was just a survivor. But also someone who could reach beyond those circumstances, who wanted to see beyond her situation into other worlds, and like anyone does. The series that ran, so I followed her for a year. A series ran in the New York Times, a five-part series. It was very much about that. It was about that room, that shelter, that experience of Dasani living with 9 family members in one room, a few blocks from townhouses that sold for millions, and her trying to reach for more and this unfair burden that had been placed on this kid. But what I realized as I embarked on the book and what the book I think does, at least what it did for me writing it, I will say, is it showed me the much broader texture of that story, of the history of this family, of what it meant, of what it really meant to be homeless, that it wasn't just a label, that it was an invitation to understand so many other things that go beyond this, way beyond this family, that go into systemic structures that keep families like this in the situation.
Have you heard this line? I just heard it again recently too. It was like, I used to live in the world, now I live in public housing. And I'm so mad that I can't think of who said it.
I used to live in the world and now I live in public housing. And that's so funny because Auburn Shelter was in the middle of public housing. It was
One of the things that you get in the book and one of the things that you get in the story is one, how challenging it was even to get to public housing. And so when we think about who we see and who we don't see, I think sometimes we think about public housing as being like, why are you still in public housing? Why are you living in Section 8? And I think one of the things that that you helped like animate is the way in which it is actually a struggle sometimes to get to public housing. One, the sort of cost, because you still have to pay some costs. But two, the burden it is to get to the situation that allows you to be able to pay that cost and to get off of the waiting list and to just be able to move in that way. And so I thought that that line, I thought it was really profound, but then it made me, your book and the Times piece made me think that it's a world outside of public housing. And I know people who are homeless, who have been homeless. And I realized that Invisible Child is not just an indictment on the system, but I think the invisible implies to all of the ways we fail to see. And so I guess one of the things I would like to ask you is, it feels Dickensian in a way, and spending so much time in this world and writing so beautifully about it. I wonder how have people responded, not just like Dasani and her family, but have you ever been able to like talk to other folks who live in that world and see how they respond to telling their stories?
Oh, I mean, I could still be there with my notepad and my pen writing down these stories. I alluded to this in the original series. I said, gentrification has this way of erasing history. People come in as if they've discovered the place. Dasani's there as a homeless kid, randomly placed in a shelter. However, she had roots that reached deeper into Fort Greene than many people in Fort Greene. She went four generations back. And so I alluded to in the series, because I remember writing something like, her family history would fill volumes were it ever told. And then I set out to do it in 2 years, and 8 years later, 14,000 records later, school report cards, dental records, every agency's interaction with the family, 132 hours of audio later, 28 hours, I actually logged this stuff, a video later, because I
You messed me, because I was going to ask you a question about like, wait a minute, what does it mean?
My process?
Yeah, and not even your process, right? But it's this fascinating thing. Like Dasani wants to tell a story, and she has something that most of us don't, which is that she now has insight in the process that it takes in terms of how do you accumulate enough information to tell a story. You know, and I just wanted to know, like, not so much as the process, but one, the raw data, you know, like everybody wants to be a writer, and they'd be like, yo, I'm gonna write me a book, and they have no idea where to begin to marshal facts. I am not a journalist, I'm more of a fabulist. and I recognized though that when I started doing some long form stuff and working with the New York Times Magazine, and people be like, these people crazy, they'd be like, well, how do you know that's true? I fucking said it. But fact checking will teach you that you saying it is not sufficient, right? And so what I wonder though is like, how do you go about understanding how much data is needed to tell the story?
You know? I mean, it's just, I am an insecure over reporter. So I just always assume I don't have it right. And I obsess and obsess and obsess. At one point, my editor, Kate Medina, I call her Kate the Great at Random House. I think this was like 5 years ago. She said, I think this story has taken possession of you. But I mean, I have timelines. That's one way I do it. That go back, they're hundreds of pages long. So a great colleague of mine at the New York Times, Benjamin Weiser, taught me this back when I was like on Metro doing court stuff with him. He's brilliant. He said, anytime, if you're working on a big story, and he really knew how to do that, anytime anything happens, plug it into the timeline. It doesn't matter how granular, how small, how big, because once you, what you start to see with the timeline, and mine became color-coded. So policy was in gray, the family things that events that happened to the entire family were in yellow.
Tell us again what you put the timeline on. Did you put
just
it in
a Word document? So I would just plug things in. Certain sets of records were green, other sets of records were red, and so I could track the sourcing, and then I would do the date and what happened. And then I basically arrayed that timeline against a whole wall of the New York Times. This was just for the series, but now I have one for the book. What you can see is you can start to see connections between events that are small, that are in the family, and huge events.
All right, now you got to prove this.
Yeah, I know. As soon as I said that, I was like, yes. I mean, I remember, you know, certain things colliding. For instance, I have to go back and look now, but the crack epidemic, for instance. You know,
and I should tell the audience one thing that I found really impressive is that the one thing that frustrates me about conversations about poverty from the public space.
Tell me.
First, they always overlap with conversations about drug addiction. But I grew up in a very mean place, and I don't mean I grew up in a necessarily uber violent place or a necessarily deeply impoverished place, but like a friend of mine, Jericho Brown, has a poem that says the 80s that shot words into the dictionary like crackhead. And this is how we talked about people. And you feel it in the book, and you feel it in the cover story about how Dasani was navigating that tension. And I think what you did an excellent job of in terms of how this overlaps with the war on drugs and how this overlaps with other things that stigmatize folks is that you were able to tell Chanel's story, and she had like this kind of, she was bubbly, you know what I mean? She was like, she wasn't, I feel like it was a real danger of writing a book like this and not caring for the people that you wrote about. And I don't mean like caring for them, like, you know, you invite them home for dinner or to the barbecue, which you may do, but I mean like caring for them enough to like,
oh yeah,
you know, like seriously.
But sure, you don't have to. I, in my case, there was a lot of overlap in our lives of just being together, and mostly me in their space. But they know my children. They've had many dinners with us. I mean, I feel that, yes. But I hear what you're saying. You know what's so interesting? You used the word Dickensian before, Duane. The condition.
I was just trying to sound intelligent.
No, but yeah, right. Well, so am I, by the way. That's our downfall. Why don't we just try to put those thoughts aside and just speak our truths? I mean, you know, but no, you're not.
But Dickensian, like Charles Dickens has started a book that's like, I started reading Oliver Twist to my son, and I got to page 2. And he was like, oh, wait a minute. Uh-huh. His mother died, his father died, and he had to work in a factory. We only on page 2. He was like, so that's why I feel like the Sonny story is Dickensian in that way. You know, it's like a lot. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I wrote the word down when you said it, because it's, people said this also about the series, and it was, there were these shocking, there were the conditions of their room were shocking to anyone, including them, by the way, in the very beginning. But you have to survive that, so you become inured to it. And I think the challenge with a story like this, and this goes to your point about drug addiction as well, and I have a sibling who has struggled all his life with the serious addiction, it's very familiar territory to me. I think there are many dangers, as you just pointed out, with a book like this. There's a lot of traps to fall into. And I think that the challenge again and again is to try to go deep enough inside the experience of the people you're writing about, which you can't ever fully know. You can't, but you just try, so that when we experience that horrible room at the very beginning of the book, we experience it at first as a shocking thing, but then Dasani's inside it. And then Dasani is navigating her way around it. She's getting the bottle, she's feeding the baby. And I took it another step forward, and this took a few years because we kept going back to that room and talking about it. where is her agency and where is her dignity? Where is her sense of agency? Her sense of agency was, I'm going to attack these mice and I'm going to kill them every single week. And in the beginning, when she used to talk about that with me, I would get like freaked out because it's like, don't tell me about smashing your eyes out one more time.
I had a mouse crawl on me in prison. One. Mind you, I'm in prison. And listen, it horrified me. It was one mouse. I was in a, and it was a field mouse, and I was in prison and I was asleep and I felt something on my leg and I kicked and I knocked it off and I saw it run out of the room. And I used to build a barricade up to like prevent anything. I didn't know they didn't have a spine. And so when I read that part, it was two things that struck me is that even in describing, it reminded me in some ways of like Black Boy, but just in describing, or maybe his Native Son, but what it reminded me of is in describing her response to it, it was even dignity in that because ultimately you have to get by. But I think that like the whole family was like, how do we organize our lives in a way in which this chaos is not determinative of what we do every day? And so you like separate the space in the house to create room for yourself. Everybody has a little space and you do your homework on that space, even if it means you just sit there and you do your homework sitting on a mattress. I thought that, and this is why I thought it was Dickensian, though. Not, I don't think of Dickensian as like depressing necessarily. I think of Dickensian as like when you write a story about somebody who finds a way through the worst kinds of circumstances. And I thought that that was powerful about it is that it was so much of her attempting to do that. And it's hard, you know, and that's what came across to me too, how it is really hard to make your way through in some circumstances, but I felt a person pushing to do it, whether it was Supreme or Chanel or her, like it came through even in a space of 5,000 words. And that's why I know the folks who are watching now and listening will really enjoy the book. I keep cutting you off because I don't want you to give all of the good stuff away.
Good. No, definitely I won't. I think you and I would agree most likely that another trap of this kind of story tends to be this like escape from poverty, you know, romance that people have in their minds, that's the story we celebrate, the one kid who made it out versus all these kids who are just as talented, but who for whatever reason, and I think there are many reasons that are very clear that have to do with the problems of the neighborhood, the lack of access to better education, to better job opportunities, to basic housing. Only 2% of Americans are housed in either Section 8 or public housing at this point. My father created and helped to implement Section 8. So that's what he did as general counsel of HUD. And it's something that's I never talked about publicly. I wasn't going to talk about, and then he died. It's so interesting, and we talked about it only a little bit here and there as I was working on the book because, you know, I this is my book and that was his thing. But and there's flaws with Section 8, but look, it does a lot to lift people out of poverty to have a voucher to get you pay part of your rent paid. Or most of it paid. And Dasani's family actually benefited off of this program, benefited from it twice in major ways. So housing is so central, right, to their lives. And this, we have just such a shortage of affordable housing. So how do you, with a family that also, if you go back to her great grandfather, June, who came to Brooklyn at a time when everything was redlined, he had fought in World War II, he had survived three battles. He'd come back as a Buffalo soldier at a time when the military was segregated to the laws of Jim Crow after fighting Nazis abroad, comes to Brooklyn and the GI Bill's just been passed and can't get a mortgage. I mean, that's where I think.
But this is actually where, you know, it's interesting. This is where, and what's really powerful about that story, I'm sorry, keep talking.
No, please jump in.
No, my wife told me that I have the very masculine habit of interrupting people more intelligent than me. And I was like, I'm a fucking genius. And she was like, that is what MacArthur said. I did not call you a genius. I called you my husband and you need to stop cutting me off. And so I'm sorry for cutting you off. Keep going.
I am guilty of interrupting people all the time. So no, please. You were about to say something about something powerful.
I was going to say what's really powerful about that is like, I do think that like Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece on reparations. And I think what he tried to do is sort of track this narrative of redlining. And he also tried to place it within families. But what makes your book really powerful is that when we place narratives within these larger structural arguments we make, it feels like we chose the narrative for that argument. But the story you're telling illuminates the way in which, no, it's a lot of invisible stories that overlap on this structural injustice. I mean, imagine fighting in a war and not being able to get a loan to buy a house, and how that undercuts, you know, generational wealth and housing security.
He settled for renting in Fort Greene houses, which Dasani would come to call the projects. That's where her roots began four generations earlier. And he couldn't work as a mechanic because labor unions were largely exclusive of Black workers. And he was trained as a mechanic, but he wound up working as a janitor. And if you look at the gap in those two wages over 20 years, he lost at least nearly $200,000 over that 20-year period. I have his wage records. If you look at what he wound up being able to earn versus what he should have earned. And so it's so essential. But it's I love that you point out that sometimes people try to, some books read like you're fitting the story within the narrative. I promise you, and I say this with just, it's not even humility or anything, it's just the truth. This story showed me this, Dasani showed me the story at every step of the way. Her family's history showed me the story. I didn't know the story. I kept trying to understand certain things, and then a new layer would be revealed and a new layer. And this is why I kept going. And I don't think I understood the arc until 5 years in, and went with the genealogist back into the family's history, to the white enslavers in North Carolina, of June Sykes's great grandfather who was born enslaved, and understood that arc. I mean, all of these pieces are interconnected, and it's, I think that that's maybe hopefully why the book reads that way. It's because I didn't know what the narrative was. I saw things happen in real time and then tried to make sense of them, you know?
What's beautiful about it is like, I remember being in prison and learning about like narrative nonfiction. And you know, what I realized is that part of me not knowing what it was is that we don't have access to tell stories in certain ways to young people. Yeah. And so they don't necessarily know how stories exist. And so what I was really being introduced to was like James Baldwin and things like that. And I think the work you're doing and you know, fits into that tradition. And what I love about this particular story is that like Dasani gets to witness that, and Dasani gets to think about, and her whole family really, but gets to think about how they'll tell their own stories, and how stories get shaped and stories get told. I am supposed to go to the Q&A. I have more questions. But just to acknowledge that the audience exists, the audience has been growing too. I sort of feel like people have been tweeting about what we've been saying. They'd be like, we got to hear this. This is the first event. I should really say that this is the first of many events for a book that I know is going to be like well honored in the year to come. And so I'm glad folks are taking the time to come. But Michael, I'm not going to say people's last name. I'm going to keep asking questions myself too, but I just want to weigh the audience in so they feel involved. But Michael says, as a writer, I'm curious about how you would recommend balancing the humanity of your subjects against the realities of their environment. Every person deserves to be represented with dignity and humanity. I'm going to answer this too, but how do you avoid glorifying the struggle of being poor? I actually don't know how you glorify the struggle of being poor. Like, I don't know if you like, do you like tell a story about somebody who like, I actually don't know how you glorify the struggle of being poor any more than you glorify the struggle of being rich. So I'm going to give my response to that question. And I know that we've talked about this a bit, but I just want to give my response because I actually think like we talk in cliches unintentionally. And what I think the question really asks is like, how do you write in a way that doesn't make us believe you hate your subjects? But I think one of the ways you do that is not to hate your subjects. Because I know that's what I'm saying. It's like, I don't think anybody, like, I don't know what it means to glorify the struggle of being poor. And it's weird because nobody ever says that when they write a piece about Bezos, they are glorifying the triumph of being rich, right? It's only that when we talk about poor people that if you show them being triumphant, if you show them being successful, if you show them really making it, even if you do it well, people ask you, are you trying to glorify the triumph of being poor? And it's a weird fascination that we have with believing that we must somehow denigrate people who suffer. And so maybe to flip that question a bit, I will ask you, did you feel the need to put more attention on some of the worst aspects of Chanel's life or Supreme's life as you tried to tell this story? Because it's like a real balance, even in a cover story, where like you can see this tension between Dasani and Supreme and how Supreme is moving and controlling the money, but you really resist trying to stigmatize Supreme for those decisions that he's making around how like that check might be what he owns. And so I wonder, like, how did you navigate that tension? So maybe not how did you navigate the tension of glorifying the poor, but how did you navigate the tension of not falling into the pitfall of denigrating struggle in a way that seems justified because you think you would have did it better?
I think it's really important in a story as complex as this to allow the reader to experience the story and to not interfere by imposing judgments. And it's hard because we all bring our lens, right? We're all human. I think the closer I get to a person, just in terms of feeling, like I really, if I feel great empathy for somebody I'm writing about, and I've done this, you know, I've been in journalism for more than 20 years doing kind of long form work like this where I immerse in people's lives. My rule of thumb is just the closer I get, the harder I'm going to have to work when it comes to writing to make sure that I'm cognizant of any potential, you know, I don't like words like balance and objectivity, and I don't think anyone does anymore like those words. it's so fashionable to say objectivity doesn't exist. Fine, we all agree. But like to be even more precise, you know, let's have many different people read this book and respond to it so that I am making sure that I've done right by it. Chanel is very brave. She never once asked me to keep anything out. She said, the truth hurts. She said that again and again. And it's interesting, you know, people often ask me, how do you think you're following them? Affected things, changed things. One thing I would say is
people ask you that, including people in the Q&A. So that's the next
yes.
question.
All right. Fair enough. Yes. I mean, there's no question that me being in the room is going to have some kind of immeasurable or measurable impact. And it depends. And there were many, many different situations I still am in their lives. I mean, this was nearly a decade of reporting.
They like your cousins. I mean, at least like play cousins.
I mean, I slept on their floor at times. I ate food with
it's
them.
It's so funny that you didn't get that joke.
Okay, I didn't really get that joke. You're right.
But your response was a definition of what a play cousin is, though. You know how like one of the interesting things happens in a community, in a poor community, but around Black folks, though, is you got people that's related to you for real. And you got play cousins. You'd be like, who is that? Oh, that's my cousin. And it's not really your cousin.
And
what I get from your book, though, is this kind of intimacy that you got with these folks that is endearing, but I think it's also human. And so when you talk about they know who my children are, yes. When you talk about, you know, we've been around each other for a decade, I mention it because sometimes we think about our subjects, and I think the audience thinks about our subjects, and we ask a question like, what happened as the result of you're writing about them? And like one of the things that happens that matters is we became close.
Yeah.
You know, like the world didn't necessarily shift for me or for them, But like we became close. I became somebody that they would call upon, and they became somebody that I would call upon. And that's essentially like what a play cousin is. So
yes,
so,
yes, so it was absolutely.
And honorific title.
I have grown up, you know, with many play cousins. I have a big Chilean family. My mother's side. But anyway, I mean, I know what you're saying. What I wanted to say about Chanel is, it's funny what we wound up realizing. I think this is potentially how me being around, this is one of the ways that, and I don't know what me not being around would have resulted in differently. And I don't for a moment take away from her agency and her, if anything, I was a bother and a really annoying presence much of the time. I wasn't, I hate it when people are like, oh, do you think you were a model? Absolutely not. Was I a role model? Dasani has the most powerful role models and people like her Black principal, Paula Holmes, who passed away, who was a mighty, amazing woman. Her teacher, Faith Hester, her grandmother, Joni. She has remarkable role models. She would say that herself. I was this strange being who had come in from this other place of journalism, of a different upbringing in a different city. And I was there watching and laughing and sharing and sometimes even crying with them, the worst moments. I had a lot of really intense experiences being among them, with them. But the thing that struck me with Chanel was that we finally came to understand that I was the author of her, of this book. Okay, of course. But I would say to her, but you're the author of your life and I'm just following your life. So was that in the back of her mind? And certain junctures, did she choose differently? If I hadn't been there, would she have chosen differently? Would she have acted differently? I don't really know. All I know is that I'm sort of beside the point. I know that it's an important question, but I feel that really the book is about them. And that's the, what I want to talk about is the story of them.
Right. And I also think it's like, yeah, and it's interesting because I think that the role of writing about humanity, and this is whether you're a fiction writer or poet or journalist, is to find a way to get into spaces and be human in those spaces. And you know, it's artifice, but if you're there long enough, it stops being artifice. You know, you're around somebody for 10 years, they would like, Chanel was probably like, I don't know if Andrea gonna write that book. I mean, she say she gonna write
it. Oh,
yeah. But...
oh, there were many times, trust me.
You know, like literally, my publisher was like, my editor was like, definitely. Yo. They was like, congratulations. I was like, yeah, man, I'm gonna get this book done. And when you said it took you 10 years, my heart was like, oh, I got a shot at finishing, you know?
No, I went from like this esteemed journalist in the New York Times writing this thing to like this weird person who just always hangs around them. It's my point. Like,
see, this is,
it
this
got
is
like awkward. The, it got awkward, but not for them, but for everyone around us. It's like, what is the deal?
Who it's is like, she? Yo, was she writing? How long does it take to write a book? How long does it take to write a book? I mean, no wonder most of us aren't writers. I can't spend 10 years on one book, but I will say that like revealing that to all of the writers who are listening, I hope it encourages all, it encourages me to believe that like great art takes time. And I have to ask one question about sentences before I go back to this other author question. I think you have some like really lovely sentences. And one of the things I like to believe, or I like to point out, is the way that like you said, the first sentence in a Times piece, right? It says, all her life, she had been hearing about Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a beautiful opening to a piece. She could have been hearing about anywhere. And what I wonder is, in terms of how you organize ideas in the sentences, this is like really me just inside baseball, turning this into a craft lesson.
Wonderful, I love it.
But how do you approach, you know, no, I was like, how do you approach this sentence? You know, how do you approach creating a story out of all of that mountain, the mountain of data that you collected?
Yeah, I mean, I suffer, and some of it's suffering, some of it's delightful. A lot of the time it's just writing. And then I don't call myself a writer. I call myself a rewriter. I've never written something that just lasted as it in its original form. I mean,
you got to go to poetry.
You put it down. Oh, maybe that's my next act. You put it down. So I know myself well enough now to know that whatever I write, however decent I think it is, no matter what, if I give it some room to breathe, by the next morning, there are changes. It's ear. And I read my stuff out loud and just over and over and over until it starts to sound right, but it doesn't usually for a while. And there's a lot of moving things around and stuff will just happen. Like, but you have to kind of give into the suffering of it. For lack of a better word, sometimes it's more just sort of chaos, but it's like, but I loved this story so much. I loved the people in the story and their humor and their wisdom and their brilliance. And, you know, also all of the ironies. And, you know, one thing I did, Duane, is I would walk around always, I still do, with a notepad and write stuff down as it came to me.
I think it's your notepad. And that was a stupid question, but like, I got a friend who carries around a notepad that's like this big. You think he really writes things that he could read in that? Cause I always feel like I carry around this, and then what happens is I'm like, hold up, let me write it, and it doesn't work. And I think writers, you know,
you raise a very good question. In the DC Bureau of the New York Times, they have these little notepads that, for whatever reason, nowhere else at the paper. And this is a little bit dated, but it may still be the case. But back when I was doing stuff down there, I was covering. I was actually on the Guantanamo story once upon a time. I remember just grabbing whole stacks of them because they were so little. I think it's important to have them be portable, but you can even do it in your phone. Sometimes I leave voice memos. It's just that the thought is fleeting otherwise. And I had something called train notes. This was in the very beginning. Actually, it was a special notepad, train notes, that I carried with me that I only...
Well, you would be an excellent sociologist. I mean, even...
Well, I don't know if the sociologists would agree, but...
I'm a bootleg sociologist, so you know, I'm like almost certified.
Well, so on the train, there's a 45-minute ride between Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and where I was living uptown and on the Upper West Side, and I would just put everything I was feeling down in that notepad, and a lot of those initial observations made their way into the book. And this was from 2012, years and years ago. But when it's fresh and when you're new and attending to what you're noticing as a newcomer to the story versus where you are having been 8 years with the family, those are two different things. And I feel like they're both essential to good narrative. And the great thing about the passage of 8 years is that you have the privilege of this incredible experience of having seen time pass and growth happen. And I mean, this kid grew up in front of me, you know?
Yeah. That's fascinating. I mean, it's actually, I like the way you connected it both to, because sometimes we think of like these craft questions of how you do something. It's just about sausage making, but it's actually about how to make yourself more equipped to notice the thing that you care about. And you can't write about something, you can't attend to something. You know, I like, you say write about something, but I like, you know, you can't attend to something for that long without deeply caring about it. And the ways in which you care matter. And like the idea of being able to take train notes and the idea of being able to like use a small notepad to capture things. I think it's how you get a line like this. And then I'm gonna ask this question from the audience. Early in the piece, you say this, and it's so beautiful, right? Because you talk about irony. The reader wouldn't necessarily know from the first sentence why this is ironic, right? None of Dasani's seven siblings had ever left home. And it's a line that's both about having, like the question is, I wonder if separating from the audience, from Ryan, he says, I wonder if separating Dasani from her family in order to offer her a good education is both harmful and beneficial. Every child should have access to such an education without separating from their family, right? But what's dope about that sentence is you're talking about the fact that they had never left home to get the education that she had, but they also hadn't been separated from their family. You know, you had times when the mother was gone or the father was gone, but I think it's something powerful in arguing that like staying together matters and it's actually an accomplishment. Because some people think having never left home is not an accomplishment, but what gets revealed in the piece is having never left home also is an accomplishment because it is quite easy to be like permanently separated from your people, you know?
There's nothing more important, I think, to most of us than these bonds of family. And I think that's just the way human beings are. And we do it in different ways. Some of us have chosen families, right? It doesn't have to be blood kin. For Dasani, her family was her system of survival. She went through all these other systems with names that suggest help, like public assistance, like child protection, like criminal justice. You think about the names, right, attached to those systems. Those to her were systems you had to navigate, you had to survive. In order to do that, she relied on her siblings and her parents, and they really considered one another one being. It wasn't, there was so little individualism there. It was just an incredible experience of togetherness. And it wasn't at all pretty sometimes, right? I mean, there were a lot of, you know, every family. Can you imagine living in one room with your 9 family members? I mean, my brothers and I would have murdered one another. I mean, so we practically did anyway. So, I mean, you know, it's intense, the relationships in those families, but beautifully so. And when she left to go to Hershey, Pennsylvania, that was a lot. That was, to her mind, that was too much to ask of her. She shouldn't have had to leave in order to get the education she deserved. And she doesn't, by the way, want to escape. And this is the problem with the word escape. When people link that word to narratives around poverty, that you escaped this neighborhood, you got out. Dasani doesn't want, she's proud of her family, her neighborhood, her streets. And by the way, as a homeless person, she's not without a home. She said it to me, home is family. It's the streets I grew up on. It's the people who've had my back ever since I was little. That is home. And she wants to thrive in that home. And she's doing it in her own way right now. She became the first of the children to graduate from high school, and she started at LaGuardia Community College. So she's staying.
And I went to community college, straight up. Like, you know, I mean, I went to community college. I did pretty well. Then I went to University of Maryland. You know, a lot of people denigrate what that journey looks like. And I hope that Dasani knows that, like, it's a legit journey, you know, and it has really unpredictable destinations. But you know, pleasant ones. I met my wife. My wife went to community college.
But you also went to Yale.
Yeah, no, that was later though. I guess I mentioned that I went to community college because I want Dasani to know if she's watching this.
Yeah.
But I was somebody when I went to community college, and when people like denigrated community college, people around me, I was like, shit. I like my professors. I like the work that I'm doing. I am somebody in this space, and this is the beginning of something. This is actually just something, actually, you know, and to know that this is something. And I feel like that's what she was saying about home. Like, I have a home, and my siblings and my mama and Supreme are something. And I feel like your book gives them like that dignity. And that's one of the things that's frequently missing. You know, when you look at somebody that's poor, you always judge them by what's missing and never give credence to what's there. And I feel like in your writing, you actually do the opposite. You give credence to what's there, even if what's there is a struggle. You know?
Can I say something, Dave? Thank you so much for saying that. You said earlier something about how, you know, you spend this much time with a family, you can't help but care. I think I would go further and say that not only is it fine to care, and I think it's essential in a way to develop. I used to see in my, you know, days as an old school, whatever, I am an old school reporter, no matter what, it's shoe leather reporter through and through, Metro is my home. I've always done those kinds of stories, you know, and I was at the Miami Herald, but you had, we, you know, back in the day, I mean, it was like, I'm the reporter with the reporter hat on. You're the person I'm writing about. I ask the questions, you answer them. I'm here to do the story on deadline. My evolution has taken me in a very different direction where I no longer see that dividing line as, not only is it not necessary, I almost see it as an impediment. I think that the writing, the power of the story rises or falls on the level of intimacy that you feel for it. And it's not only okay, it's almost necessary to feel, whether it's caring for them or not, or feeling angry, whatever it is, you know, you have to take that in order to have it work in a clear and powerful manner in the writing. I think it's not at all a perfect process. And there are many checks and balances, and there's a need for balance and all of that. But, you know, if that makes sense, I think it's.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it does.
Wait.
I want to make sure that I ask, specifically let you address Ryan's question and T. Simmons's question. And so Ryan says, every child should have access to such an education without separating from their family, right? I think we both agree that that's yes. But one of the things Ryan asks is if separating Dasani from her family in order to offer her a good education is both harmful and beneficial. I wonder if you might talk about some of the ways in which that separation might have been, you know, both harmful and beneficial. And I know it's in a book, and I encourage Ryan and everybody listening to read the book. But just because it's obvious that that's one of the main things, it'd be nice to have Ryan know a bit more.
I think the parts of Hershey that were beneficial did not have much to do with her separating from her family. I think had her family been given the resources, just monetarily, I'm talking about, because they taught their kids, Chanel and Supreme, had them read the dictionary every night. If they had enough food, if they had the kind of resources that were available at Hershey, Dasani would have been able to thrive educationally. I think that obviously there are other issues with the parents. They are survivors of deep childhood trauma, both of them, and have addictions that they've come in and out of over the years. And were in drug and continue to be in treatment programs and currently doing really well. But this is a lifelong battle. But it as you said earlier, it's a mistake to kind of just focus on the addiction as a reason to sort of turn away, or when we never do that, by the way, with upper middle class people, right? It's like, oh, but
I do that shit all the time, though.
Depressed, or I mean,
I do it all the time. I'd be like, what, Mr. Joseph?
Yeah,
he fell off the wagon. We should evict him. And they'd be like, he owns his house. Oh man, we can't evict. You know, it's like that funny thing with one of the reasons why we don't do that for upper middle class people and middle class people, because it's like so many resources in place that you can mask your struggles, you know, and you could literally hide them for decades.
Right. But Hershey was fascinating for Dasani, and she did thrive. And maybe some of it was, look, there are plenty of kids from other backgrounds, from well-off families or whatever, who take off when they get away or they go to boarding school. They feel free. They're out of the misery. They're away from their miserable parents' marriage or whatever it is. I mean, there can be upsides, but I think the main thing for Dasani was that when she left, a serious and essential part of that family engine was removed. She was so essential. The very things that gave her so much promise in the eyes of like her teachers, like the things that her gifts were, the things that made her indispensable, you know, to her parents. I mean, those are often sort of the same kid. It's the kid that is, Dasani is beautifully gifted, but at the same time, quite representative. I don't want to make her as an out to be exceptional at all. I think she's so representative of so many kids who, if they were just had slightly different circumstances, would thrive. And it's not because of a lack of willpower or talent or ambition that they don't. And that's what I think is so important about her story. But
the piece you just said was actually a little frightening, because the very thing that makes people notice you might be the very reason why you're needed at home. Yeah. And I mean, the height of success, I don't know. I left home. You know, I don't live in a city where I grew up in. And I mean, I left home first to go to prison, but when I came home, I left again. And I think in some ways, one of the burdens that you write about that Dasani showed is like, what does it mean to have something that's of value to the people you love the most? And have that very thing be the thing that allows you to leave the people you love the most. And I think that's why I called it Dickensian, not because it's wallowing in any way in a kind of tragedy, but it's making us contemplate the human dilemma, which for better or for worse, like I think Dasani still has to compliment, I mean to confront.
Yeah.
I think I want to give you the last word and maybe the last word for me is just gonna be two words. You know, 10 years is a long journey for any writer, and it's just a huge accomplishment to write this story. It's a huge accomplishment to come out on the other side, still caring about your subjects and have them still caring about you. And but more importantly, I think it just takes a lot of beauty to spend some of those hours writing a sentence well. And so the last words I'll just say is really thank you for what you've written and what you've offered to us. You know, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. And I want to thank Dasani, who I believe is watching, and Chanel and Supreme. And
oh, man, they could be like, who the fuck is this talking? You got this dude cursing all the damn time. Writers could curse like that shit. Dasani would be like, I'm going to be a writer. Fuck it. I didn't even know that this was possible. Damn. This dude won what kind of grant? Anyway, I really enjoyed myself. Thank you. I hope thank the audience did too.
I hope they did too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.